Hello, Avani Dias here. This is the Hack Podcast. And have you used a dating app? In the 10 years they've been around, dating apps have led to everything from casual hookups to new friendships to bad experiences and even wedding bells. And you're going to meet the person who created one of the first and now most popular dating apps, Hinge, later on this podcast. He'll give us tips on what not to do on a dating profile, the best times to transition to meeting someone in person, which is a pretty fine art. Plus, on this episode, I've got some good news for you on the bushfires. They're totally out for the first time in 240 days in New South Wales. So we're going to meet the people regenerating now and dealing with that tough task of bringing back native species after the fires.
Hack. 4 dozen countries reporting cases. We have community spread in many different parts of the world. This is a pandemic by any definition.
Now with cases of people being diagnosed without having travelled outside Australia, experts will look at whether more social distancing measures are needed.
On Triple J.
You know when you're in the mosh at a festival or a gig, or you're sitting next to someone at a footy game, or you're at a big protest? It'd be so hard to know if someone around you had coronavirus or COVID-19, which is the technical name. So the government wants to avoid that from happening, and its announced laws are likely to come into action soon, which could prevent you from going to large gatherings like that. Authorities will also be able to forcibly detain you if you've got symptoms of the virus. And I know we've been telling you a lot about coronavirus lately, but the situation is changing every day. So I want to keep you updated because there's so much misinformation out there as well. Professor Ian McKay is one of Australia's leading virologists. He's from the Australian Infectious Diseases Research Centre. Ian, we spoke to you a couple of weeks ago, and back then you said you expected coronavirus to become a pandemic, which is the worldwide spread of the disease. And now it seems like that's imminent. When do you see it happening?
That seems like a lifetime ago. Look, I think that could be happening any time now, really. As you heard in that intro, there are a lot of countries that have spread, not really widespread, but spread of the virus to them. I think we've gone from 29 to 61 countries in only that period of time since we last spoke. So a big jump in country numbers, but each of them so far have only got a few cases. So we're not there yet, but we're getting there.
And the Australian government said, you know, worst case scenario is we go to the highest level of emergency and that is declared. And then we would face things like people showing symptoms of coronavirus being detained. They could be forced vaccinations, forced to wear gowns or masks, forced to tell health authorities your medical details. Is that the right approach?
That's all the worst stuff that could happen. I think we need to look at some of the good stuff. We might get some time off work. We might have some more time with our kids. You know, there's good stuff there as well. Plus, we might get to watch a lot of Netflix and do a few things like binge watching some of the other stuff. In all seriousness, some of those events could happen, but that's pretty extreme and we're not likely to see a lot of that unless people decide they do want to stay infected and risk other people's lives by spreading the virus wantonly.
Do you see that emergency level being declared anytime soon, though, where those things could happen?
I think the level where those things could happen could be described or could be an issue soon, sure. But whether or not they need to be enacted really depends on us and how far and fast the virus spreads and exactly what it does once it gets here. It'll be interesting to see how the virus acts in our population. We've seen most of our data from China and we've got different questions to ask about that.
You sound pretty lighthearted about it in terms of, you know, being able to stay home and hang out with your mates and so on. Are we kind of overreacting with the fear that's going around? There's a new paper out saying today that as we find out more about COVID-19, it may not be as deadly as people were first saying. What do you think?
Look, I really don't mean to be lighthearted about it. It's a serious virus. I have 2 kids and a wife and a family, and I think it's a virus we need to take more seriously than we took the 2009 pandemic influenza, for example. It seems to be able to kill more people and perhaps make more people severely ill, spending multiple weeks in hospital, even maybe in intensive care for the older groups. So it is something we need to take seriously. We need to listen to authorities. It's not like other things we've had before. No two pandemics are ever the same. But on the other hand, we also need to keep this in context. A lot of the cases will be mild. We will see some things happen like closures of events and mass gatherings not happening, and that's sort of getting in a mosh pit, a mass gathering really. Some of those things might be stopped, but it's not the end of the world. We're really trying to slow down spread so we don't get our hospitals overwhelmed by this virus.
Yeah, but in terms of people getting coronavirus, I guess, is it likely that people you and I and everyone else knows will end up getting it and we'll see more cases of it, but they won't be at a deadly stage? Is that fair to say?
We don't know for sure, but it looks like most of them won't be at a deadly stage. Absolutely more than 90% won't be at a deadly stage. Most of those will be really bad colds, perhaps bad flus as well. In that 20%, we'll be looking at some that have to go to hospital for a while. And again, a percentage, maybe less than a percentage, that will actually die. Most of those are going to be our elderly people, where that effect is really going to be most noticed because they have, in some cases, underlying diseases that this virus really preys on. It's an opportunistic virus that way. But it's not all bad. We will learn some things about the virus and how to stop getting infected ourselves, which are really applicable to the flu as well. If we can learn to wash our hands more often and stay away from sick people, we can really cut down transmission of other viruses that causes illness every year.
Yeah, we heard yesterday about the first human-to-human transition in Australia, and the New South Wales Health Minister has come out saying, you know, don't shake people's hands, pat them on the back instead, avoid kissing where you can, hugging, which I'm actually okay with because I'm an awkward hugger. But, I mean, is that all legitimate advice as a virologist?
I'm quite happy for fewer kisses and less hugs, frankly. That's the same with me.
Yeah.
There's a great thing going around on TikTok where there's a bit of a foot tap thing you can do instead of the Ebola elbow bump.
But that's so weird.
Those are all good advice. If we can stay away from people that are sick and probably stay away from people in general when this virus starts spreading, we can slow it down. We are likely to all see an infection of it at some point because we have no immunity right now. None of us do. And that's why it's a pandemic. It's spreading amongst the susceptible population and it spreads quite happily through droplets. At some point, we'll probably all get infected. That might not be in weeks or months, it might be years, but we may see waves of this pandemic go around the world.
Yeah, right. And in terms of preparation, I went to the supermarket yesterday. There was no toilet paper. A lot of people have experienced similar things. Panic buying's happening. We've heard from researchers that's not the best way to approach it, but how do we prepare if we are to get coronavirus?
I think a little bit of buying of stuff, maybe to keep yourself self-sufficient for a couple of weeks, is not a bad idea. But we're not talking about replicating everything in your house and buying things you never would normally have or won't use later. We're just talking about making sure your prescriptions are up to date and you've got a bit extra if necessary, making sure you've got a little bit of dried food, dried fruit, some canned fruit maybe, just in case all the truckies get sick as well and we can't restock those shelves. But we're just thinking about that sort of interruption, not zombie apocalypse. We're not going to all need to stock up on chainsaws and machetes. It's not going to be like that.
Mm.
But there could be interruptions to our shelves being stocked. So we need to just think a bit about that.
All right, Ian, before we let you go, Sam from Cootamundra on the text line says, my partner's heading to Bali in about 3 weeks' time. Should there be anything to worry about? That's something we're hearing a lot from Triple J listeners. Should they be travelling overseas?
Yeah, me too. I get this question a lot, and I don't want to advise specifically people, but I would say if you are going overseas, are you thinking about what would happen if you got severely sick, if you ended up in a hospital overseas, or would you rather be sick at home in Australia where you know the healthcare and the systems? I think that's the thing to really think about in terms of also the cost and health insurance and that sort of stuff. Would that really be a problem for you, or would it be just better to maybe put it off until you see how this thing's going to play out?
All right, Professor Ian McKay from the Australian Infectious Diseases Research Centre, appreciate your advice as always, and we'll keep getting updates from you as this keeps developing. Someone on the text line says, we could lose a lot of our old people through coronavirus.
Hack. We are an app for millennials who are looking for something more serious than sort of what you might find on some of the swiping apps.
On Triple J.
About a decade ago, the only way you could meet a date was in person, like at a bar, a party, gig, through friends, whatever. But since then, things have really changed. The number one way Australians meet their partners now is through dating apps. We know more than half of Triple J listeners have used a dating app to meet people. If you're one of them, give me a call. I want to know how dating apps have changed things for you. 1-300-055-36. Let's meet one of the people who changed the game. He created Hinge. It's one of the first and most popular dating apps in the world. His name is Justin McLeod. I chatted to him today and he told me how he met his college sweetheart and that ended up inspiring the app.
We met in college. It was actually her first day of college and it was my first day of sophomore year. And I had just gotten out of drug and alcohol rehab from the summer. And I had spent my first night partying pretty hard and passed out in a stairwell, and she found me. And that was that was our like meet cute, you can say.
Yeah, right. And how long did you go out for after that?
So we dated on and off, not immediately after that, as you can imagine, but we had a class together that next semester. And we dated all through college, but a little bit on and off. You know, I really loved Kate, but I was also 20 years old at the time. And like, it's too soon to have like found the one, you know, I want to go out and live my life. But I also kept getting drawn back to her. And I think at the end of college, we just decided to go our separate ways.
So at what point did you decide to develop Hinge as we know it today? Was it after you guys broke up?
It was after we broke up, and it was actually 4 years later. So I really wanted to reach out to Kate, but I avoided it for 4 years because I was like, listen, I've probably messed with this girl's life enough. I really should just stay out of it. And 4 years later, I'm like, okay, I've got my stuff together. I'd stopped drinking and partying. I was going to Harvard Business School. I had a job offer at McKinsey, you know, prestigious consulting firms. I'm like, okay, I've got my life together. I can like reach out to her. And I did. And she told me that it was too late and that she had moved on and she was living in London with another guy and that they had got a flat together and it was just too late. And I was so heartbroken. And as someone who wasn't really going out and partying, I was having trouble meeting new people. And that's when the idea for Hinge came along, which was to create a really just simple, fun way for people my age or people in their 20s to connect with each other. Because at the time, this was 2011, so this is before dating apps as we know them today.
Yeah, how did you go from, oh no, the love of my life is with someone else to I'm going to create a dating app when that idea of dating apps wasn't even around then?
Yeah, I guess I'm dramatic. I you know, I was always a romantic. I was, you know, I loved to code as a kid. So I think like there were sort of pieces of it in place that led me there. But what actually happened is that the business school was going to throw this last chance dance party where everyone was going to list their crushes. And so I'd gotten wind that they weren't going to do that. And I like really wanted this to happen. So I took it on myself to code something up that would allow people to list their crushes and find out if, you know, there were any like last chance encounters before we graduated business school and moved on. That idea just started sparking for me that like, gosh, it's so crazy. You know, we have Facebook, we are on our mobile phones. And yet people don't, my age, just aren't using dating services. But if you made it integrated into social media and you made it on our phones, I think it would be something that our generation would accept and use. And that turned out to be right.
After you created Hinge, you were being interviewed by a journalist and that kind of triggered you to contact Kate again, your love from college. Tell us how that panned out.
A reporter reached out to me and she said that she had downloaded Hinge and wanted to do a story about me because the first person that came up on her screen she'd matched with and fallen in love with. And she wanted to know how our algorithm had done it. And honestly, it was probably blind luck at the time. And we had sort of a fine standard interview here in New York. And then at the end of the interview, she asked if I'd ever been in love. And I said, well, once a long time ago, but I didn't realize it until it was too late. And she turned off her tape recorder and she wanted me to tell her a story. So I told her the story of Kate in all its twists and turns. And, you know, she sort of like stopped and she's like, listen, I really have to tell you a story. And she told me this reciprocal story about her and how she found the love of her life that from her young days, 20 years later, and they realized they should have been together. And she was like, you really like, if you still love her and she's not married yet, you've got to go do something. You've got to go say something. And about 2 months later, Hinge was throwing a launch party in London. After she'd turned me down, I would write her every year on her birthday and would never hear back. And so I kind of had given up after a few years. And then I reached out to her this one last time and I said, hey, I'm going to be in London. Weird to think I'm never going to see you again. Would love 15 minutes sort of just to say hi and goodbye. And I actually got a response the next day and found out that she was not in London anymore. She's living in Switzerland, but she would talk on the phone. And so we agreed to talk on the phone the next day. And then I actually just drove straight to the airport, got a plane ticket to Switzerland. And when she was ready to talk on the phone the next day, I was landing in Zurich.
Hack on Triple J.
That's Justin McLeod. He created the dating app Hinge, and he ended up meeting Kate, his college sweetheart, because of that interview with that reporter. And they got back together after that meeting in Zurich, and they just got married last year. It's so crazy. They broke up. He created the app, and then somehow the app ended up bringing them back together as well. So many people texting on this. This one's pretty funny. Should we just be bumping feet now on dating apps, meetups because of coronavirus? Lol, which is, yeah, very funny. And maybe someone else has texted, yes, I met my current partner on Hinge. Another person not having as much luck, saying, I had over 100 Tinder matches and no meets, but I had 7 matches on Hinge and met 2 people. My name's Avani Dias, and later on Hack, we're going to hear more from Justin McLeod about how the app's algorithm controls our dating lives. He's also got some good tips on the best ways to go from chatting on the app to meeting in real life, which can be tough. First, though, a big update on the bushfires, and it's one to celebrate.
Hack. For the first time since early July 2019, there are no active bushfires or grass fires in New South Wales. That's more than 240 days of fire activity for the state.
On Triple J.
Today, the New South Wales Rural Fire Service posted that tweet. There are no active bush or grass fires in New South Wales after nearly 8 months. And we know things are easing in other parts of the country too. It's pretty amazing news. And now Australians have been focusing on regenerating, which is a huge task. But how do you bring back native plants destroyed in bushfires if they were already endangered before? Shalala Medora met someone doing that after last month's fires in Bredbow in New South Wales. And it's, yeah, not as easy as you think.
We're about to go up on the ridgeline up here. This is where the fire front was pushing really hard, and it was getting towards leaving the property and heading towards the town of Bredbow.
Phil Palmer is the manager of Scottsdale Reserve, a heritage bushland site on the outskirts of Bredbow near Cooma in New South Wales. In early February, bushfires ripped through this part of the world and left a trail of destruction.
Yeah, 90% of what we call our valley floor is burnt out. It was like a genocide. It really tore through the grasslands, but it took out all of the big trees, which is really sad because some of them are 300, 400, 500 years old at the oldest. And, you know, that stuff's just not replaceable.
We're driving out to parts of the 1,300-hectare property to survey the damage.
It's hard to describe without getting emotional, this part of the reserve. The 12 years of restoration that we've been doing across the properties, the fires sort of brought it back to like it was a grazed paddocks. Like, you know, people say, oh, it'll come back, but, you know, these trees may not come back, or if they do, it's many hundreds of years.
This plot of land was bought 14 years ago by Bush Heritage, a not-for-profit organisation that aims to conserve and restore native habitat.
We buy land and manage it as private nature reserves, essentially, and we also partner with Aboriginal people to help them return their country to good health.
Content coordinator for Bush Heritage, Amelia Caddy, is in the car with us. She tells me about the work her organisation is doing.
So we've got 37 reserves all across Australia, from Tassie right across to WA and up into northern Queensland. And that collectively, those reserves are protecting over 1 million hectares of land of really high conservation value.
We're just driving down the track beside the old railway reserve.
We just passed this like big section of black. You know, 2 metres down, there's like greens.
Yeah. February's fire had a massive impact on the reserve.
Yeah, I'm really devastated by the loss. 6% of our regen over the past 10 years is unburnt, so 94% is burnt. Collectively, many, many thousands of trees knocked to the ground.
Phil was lucky. He wasn't there when the fire came through. He's really thankful about the work the Rural Fire Service did in keeping this and neighbouring properties safe in extremely tricky circumstances.
The way the fire spread across the reserve was not by a big front, but the way it came through just tore through so quickly, and there was so much spotting, so much embers falling out of the smoke.
The older trees acted like a chimney, throwing embers into the air and increasing the fire risk. So the fireys made the tough decision to to bulldoze them.
And the sad part is a lot of the trees, they just weren't going to burn. And, you know, like if you can see where the caterpillar's gone up to them and just hit them, we were just being showered in embers and fires were breaking out everywhere across the reserve. See, they've gone super brittle.
On the side of the tree, so...
Rounding out the team is Dr. Matt Appleby. He's the senior ecologist for Bush Heritage. He's seeing the devastation caused by the fire for the first time.
Our eucalypts regenerate by resprouting and by seed, so after fire. So to sort of see the trees knocked over, the roots are out of the ground, they're not going to recover from resprouting on these ones. So it's basically just going to be seed regeneration.
Some of these trees, like the yellow gum, are critically endangered and have special significance for the region's First Peoples.
Oh, this was a really important tree for the Ngunnawal traditional owners. They were able to come here and most likely with a stone axe cut out a kulaman, a bowl, travel down the valley floor collecting bush foods as they went.
Matt says the impacts will be felt for a long time.
Probably what will happen, we'll get local... extinction's probably too strong a word, but the occupancy rates will go down in these sorts of areas.
I know what you're thinking. This sounds so bleak. But it's not all bad news. Just a couple of weeks after the bushfire, bird life was already coming back to the area.
Some species benefit from the fire, and certainly the raptors have moved in. The brown falcon, there's a wedgie, the wedge-tail eagles and the kestrels particularly.
There's even a silver lining.
I just wanted to share this really special occasion with you guys.
A couple of days ago, Phil posted a video.
Oh my God, he's so gorgeous.
It's the first time a koala has ever been spotted in the reserve. And conservationists like Phil, who've dedicated years of their life to regenerating native bushlands, hope it isn't the last.
Hey, buddy, check you out. I hope you hang here for as long as you want.
Hack on Triple J.
Conservationist Phil ending that story by Shalala Medora.
Hack. The first person that came up on her screen she'd matched with and fallen in love with.
On Triple J.
Earlier in the show, we spoke to the founder of Hinge, Justin McLeod, about his love story, how it led to him creating the app. And now let's figure out some things about our own love lives, how to, get off the apps and meet someone in person. And it is a fine art, but we're about to find out about it. So, I asked Justin what he thinks Hinge is for in particular, because different apps have different connotations. Some are for hookups and some are for meeting someone for a relationship.
We are the app for people who want to get off dating apps. We're the app that's designed to be deleted, because we've really engineered the entire experience around how many great dates we're setting up each week. That's what we measure. In fact, we're the only dating app out there that measures whether you went on a date and how good that date was. And that's sort of our guiding light for how we make all of our decisions, especially our product decisions at Hinge. It's not growth or engagement or getting people to spend more time in our app. It's how many great dates they're getting on. And we've really designed the experience with that metric in mind.
One big differentiation between Hinge and other apps is that there's a lot of information about the person you're, considering up front. You can, learn about their political beliefs, what they like to do on holidays, whatever. Is that too much information to know about someone that you're about to date? Because usually you would learn that as you're going along and learning about that person, right?
There are some things that are deal breakers for people or that are really important to people. And we like to have those things up front, because if you learn about it on the third date and then you realize that this person's not interesting to you, I think that it just helps people make decisions. And we really try to give you a really strong sense of their personality. And that's the leading factor on Hinge. I don't know too many people that spend too much time making their decisions based on some of those factors, although they are important to some people. But I think what's really important to people is the personality that comes across in the person.
Another major element that is different about Hinge is that there's no swiping, which is, I guess, a big aspect of other dating apps, and you've spoken about the fact that you've dealt with addiction in your life and you wanted to get rid of that kind of addictive aspect of just swiping through so many different people. Why do you think that is important to get rid of?
It really slows people down and makes you think about who you like and who you don't, because when you can just sort of make these binary yes or no decisions really quickly. I think people don't really slow down or as thoughtful about their decisions. Also, because people are more selective, it really helps our algorithm zoom in on your taste much better and much more quickly.
But has that algorithm changed things for the worse in some ways, in that it's all kind of chosen for us by this computer-generated program?
I think it's still natural once you meet them, but just like in the real world, you don't just wander like the streets randomly looking for someone, right? You would go
speak
to
for yourself.
You might, yeah. Well, but even in the back before dating apps, right? You would go to a certain bar that attracted a certain types of people, or you'd meet them in a yoga class. So it's the same thing that's happening for us. We're helping sort of curate your experience towards the people that you would want to meet. So I don't think that's any different.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J, and we're talking to Justin McLeod, who's the creator of the dating app Hinge. I do want to ask you about some questions we've got from the Triple J audience. We've surveyed thousands of people who listen to us, and 35%, both men and women, have had bad experiences on dating apps. How do you feel about that?
So we always follow up after each date to find out how the date went. We have this feature called We Met, and when people match, we follow up and say, hey, did you go on a date and how did it go? We actually find that 3 out of 4 times people go on a Hinge date, they want to go on a second date. And we actually find that in fewer than 0.1% of the cases is there ever sort of a report of something bad happening. So we generally really try to make sure that we are, again, curating the experience. And anytime anyone reports anyone for anything bad, we take that into account and remove a lot of users as a result.
I mean, some of the worst things that we've heard, especially from women, are cases of sexual assault after they've met people on dating apps. And it's a number of different dating apps, I guess I should clarify as well. But if someone is reported as an offender on a date, what happens to ensure that they won't go back on the app and keep reoffending?
We have, again, a whole team of people who are dedicated to this and making sure that we are, once someone is banned, we banned pretty much any way that they could rejoin again.
Yeah. Is there anything stopping someone from just creating a new profile under a new name though?
There are other ways just than your name that we can use to identify a duplicate account, from looking at the same photos to knowing that you use the same device to your IP address. So it's not quite that simple for someone to do that.
This is Hack on Triple J. Yeah, we're talking to the CEO of Hinge, Justin McLeod. I want to get some advice from you now before we let you go. What are the most cringe things you've seen on Hinge dating app profiles that people should be avoiding?
Sometimes people are still putting their sort of like filtered best self and like 6 selfies in a row, and it just doesn't help tell the story of who you are and really use the profile the way that it's designed. And so I really do encourage people, when they use Hinge, to really slow down, be thoughtful about the photos that they choose. Use photos that invite a conversation. A simple selfie doesn't do that, but showing your interests or showing your quirkier side definitely does. And same thing with answering the text prompts. Those are really designed to help you get into a great conversation, but it does require that you really spend time thinking about them and putting forward a response that reflects you and your personality so that people can get to know you better.
Yeah, when is the best time to go from chatting on the app to actually meeting in person? I mean, obviously there's no hard and fast rule, but what have you seen as the head of this company?
Most people do it within about 20 messages. And so I think letting it go longer than that can really lead to a drop off, or people getting sort of distracted, and it leads to what people will complain about with ghosting. So I think it's great to get a little bit of a rapport, but then after that, it's best just to invite the person to move it offline as quickly as possible.
Some great advice there. Justin McLeod, thank you so much for joining us on Triple J.
Okay, thank you.
Hack on Triple J.
So many good texts from Triple J listeners on that. So Nat and Mitch texted in. They said, we met on Tinder, texted nonstop for 4 days, met up on the 4th day, hooked up, sex and all, fell hard, have been together for over a year now, and from our experience, you should meet straight away to see if there's chemistry or you'll get bored texting for weeks. Meeting someone's all about connection. This needs to be done face-to-face and physically to see if it is real. That's interesting advice. Someone else has texted, I'm on Hinge. I'm loving it way more than Tinder. It seems more real, but at the same time, it seems to force people to emotionally invest too early. That's interesting. Yeah, well, super fascinating chat there with Justin McLeod, the CEO of Hinge. But that's all we've got time for on the podcast. I'll see you next time.